With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Can you imagine now the faux pas if you got a, you know, I don't know, a glass, and they got a milk bottle and you just chucked it in the landfill? People would, you'd be cancelled, Les, if you tweeted that.
I would be cancelled. Thank God nobody's seen me do it.
Yeah, the truth. This is what we're going to do on the podcast today. The truth about Les Dennis's yeah. bins. Get in. Hello, welcome along. This is My Mate Bought a Toaster. My name's Tom Price, and I am over the moon, cock-a-hoop, to be welcoming someone who I've always thought is just fantastic. I used to watch him on TV as a kid. I just think your career is such an example to all other performers as well. And also, Les Dennis, I have only heard the loveliest things about you. Various friends and pals of mine have worked with you. Honestly, and these people are texting me saying, oh my God, you've got Les Dennis on Toaster. He's the nicest guy. And I just want someone to say... Well, I want someone to say you're an arsehole, just to give us a bit of texture.
Oh, well, I'm pleased that they are saying those nice things. And yeah, it's been a long career. It's been, I think The Guardian in a review when I did The Addams Family, they said that Les Dennis in his long, strange career makes yet another left turn. And I kind of liked that. I mean, I thought it at first, is this damning with faint praise? But I quite liked the fact that I've managed to keep making left turns. That seems to be the sum of my career.
Totally, because if we're taking nothing but left turns, we're basically going in circles, and that's
exactly.
Fine by me.
And coming back full circle.
Go.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely not spiraling down.
No,
that's the important thing.
No, exactly.
To push that metaphor to breaking point. It is, and we'll get on. We must have a proper chat about the career, because it's an incredible thing that you do. It really is. And the way that you're perceived by everyone is fantastic. And hopefully we'll break some of that now on this show. We'll find out the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll find out the truth. The monster. All right, so we're looking at your Amazon account.
Right.
Les. Now, are you a prolific Amazon shopper, or are you going to play the that was for my family card a lot? Because we get that.
I have to say that I'm not a prolific Amazon user. I mean, I watch the movies on Amazon Prime, and I do buy occasionally. But a lot of Amazon boxes come through our house, and that's because of my kids and my wife, and I have to repackage them and put them into the recycling bin. That's my job. Uh-huh. That's my job for Amazon.
So you're basically an Amazon warehouse worker, but in your own private house.
Yeah,
that's what
like Frances McDormand in Nomadland. She's boxing it one end, and I'm the other end, unboxing and sticking it into the recycling bin if I can get it in, because there's so much stuff.
I love the idea of you dressed in overalls, maybe one toilet break per day. It's a tough life. All right, well, let's have a look. We've got a nice one here, 2013, right? So this is only, 8 years ago.
Right.
This is quite an interesting one. And he's a man, not many people have bought books by this guy. Peter James, who I really like. Peter James, The Perfect Murder.
Yes.
Good sort of, is it Suffolk Noir? Have I got the right county there?
It's Brighton. It's Brighton set with Detective Inspector Grace. Although this one isn't a Grace novel, I don't think. When it basically, The Perfect Murder is a short novel of Peter's, and it became a play. And I was asked to do the play, and so I bought the copy of the book so that I could read it. I'd already read a couple of his Detective Grace novels, but I bought this one to see, you know, what the character was like. And I played a guy who wanted to create the perfect murder. And it's a really interesting play. and I loved it. Yeah, I had a great time. Ian Talbot directed, and Peter was around. That was a lovely thing. I since have become friends with Peter James. And he's such a nice man and such a prolific writer. I think he writes a novel a year.
Yes, he's one of them. Yeah. There's a few of these guys around who do, it's often crime or thriller writers, and somehow people think, well, if it's one a year, it can't be that good. They're fantastic. They're so good.
They are. And they just did the first TV version of it with John Sim playing Inspector Grace. Yes. So I was thrilled to do it, and out of it came friendship with Ian Talbot, the director, and with lovely Peter and Laura, his wife.
Lovely Peter. And yet when he writes books, he writes the most horrific. It's so funny how, and you get this with various crime writers, they're so nice on Twitter or whatever. I follow a load of them, like Ian Rankin, for example, the nicest man.
Right.
But my God, the darkness that comes out in those books. I don't know, maybe the books are a kind of purging of all that inner darkness. I don't know.
It probably is that, exactly. You know, they're kind of letting that darker side of themselves out on paper. I have recently had a novel in my head like everybody, and then this last year I've started to write some of it out, and I'm quite shocked at the darkness that's in my head. So where does it come from? I don't know.
Tell us, how's the novel going then? Is it very much informal at the moment, or is it?
I've got about 8 chapters out, and I like the way it's going, but I don't know where it's going. That's the thing, you know. People say that you should always have your ending, and I've got an ending, but I don't know how to get there. But I love the opening. I love the idea. The idea came out of the opening. And then I started writing it down, and I've stopped. But that's just laziness. I've stopped because I'm doing other things.
I think it's the most important thing when says a man who's never had any books written or published or anything. But the most important thing when you are writing, surely, I guess it relates to this podcast. I really don't imagine anyone listening, and I would say the same about when you're writing. I think if you start imagining an audience. And I do, you know, I do a fair bit of live radio. If I actually imagine the audience, that way madness lies. If you're just doing it for yourself and it's fun, then all power to you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But then you get tempted to go, I'll just show Claire, my wife, and I'll just show maybe a friend. And funnily enough, I thought of getting in touch with Peter and saying, look, tell me straight. Here's the first 8 chapters. What do you think? Am I barking up the wrong tree?
Yes. So have you done that yet? Why hasn't that happened?
No, I haven't.
Well, for God's sake, listen, you need to take something away from today's podcast, Les, and it's that. Will you promise me you'll email Peter James after today?
I will. Okay. I will exactly do that. Okay. I mean, it feels like that stuff, though, where you know, where whatever you do, you know, you go and talk to a doctor at a party and tell them your ailment or people come up to you and say, tell me a joke, be funny.
Yeah.
Oh. And it feels like I'm then saying to Peter, look at my book and tell me it's good.
Please don't phrase it like that on the email, because that's a terrible way of writing an email. But I think that as a comedian, there's nothing worse, is there, when someone says, go on then, do a bit.
It
makes me prolapse with dread when people say that. I'm just like,
and it's usually, do your Mavis for me.
I can't imagine.
I don't do that anymore. Or people follow me with game show Tourette's. You know, they're all doing the noise behind me and are really thrilled, and they fall about laughing more than I do because they think they're the first one to do it. It's like a kind of game show Tourette's.
Yes.
They feel they've got to do it.
So we should explain, you presented Family Fortunes, didn't you, for a big chunk
for 15 years. 15 years. 15 years that show, and it was a great show to do. And it came at a time after I was in a double act with Dustin G, and Dustin sadly died in 1986, and you know, I lost my comedy partner and my best friend. And didn't know, I felt rudderless, I didn't know where I was going, and then Family Fortunes came along. So it served a wonderful purpose for me, because for 15 years I was on Saturday night TV.
Yeah.
People used to watch Family Fortunes and then Blind Date while they were getting ready to go out on a Saturday night.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a lot of people's kind of younger life. They remember that, which is lovely for me.
Yeah.
So it was a gift of a show to do.
I'm not surprised to hear this, but I'm so happy that you're not one of those grumps who hates the catchphrase that sticks with them for the rest of their life. Because I'm just like, I would love, I mean, I'm sure there are various comedians, Little Britain, who hate the fact that people pursue them and shout the catchphrase at them. But I can't imagine ever getting sick of it, because I'd be like, yeah, that is the reason that I have had the time that I've had and I'm doing the things I do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it was Richard Wilson that when somebody said to him, I don't believe it, and the person said, I bet you wish you had a pound for every time you've heard that. And he said, I have.
Exactly. That's a bit like someone asking Don McLean, what does American pie mean? Do you know this one? Do you know this one?
No.
Don McLean answered, it means I never have to work again.
Oh, that's great, isn't it? That's a lovely answer.
We should say as well, of course, with your double act, and this is a really fascinating fact that I didn't know. So you were on stage after Tommy Cooper died, weren't you?
Yes, it was live TV.
Yeah.
It was live from Her Majesty's. Tommy was closing the first half, and we, Dustin and I, were going on after the commercial break. After him, so we were following Tommy Cooper,
which in itself is hard enough.
Yeah, it's hard enough. Tommy at rehearsals in the day had never done the same thing twice. He messed about. He kind of went to his props table and brought things forwards. He was doing this routine where he had a cloak on at the end of his spot. He had this massive big cloak on, and the curtains behind him were clearly the props guys were feeding the props through the curtains and through into the cloak, and out of the cloak, Tommy would produce a lampshade and then a fire hydrant. Yeah. And the things would get bigger and bigger, and, you know, a set of steps. Yeah. And it was a hilarious routine. We'd watched it at rehearsal in the afternoon and thought he was just a genius, absolutely brilliant. Jimmy Tarbuck, the host of the show, loved him, really loved Tommy. And this was... Tommy was at a point where he needed this show. Kind of, he was just in the wilderness a little bit, but he needed this show. And he was clearly storming it. He got to that part on the night where the girl dancer walked on, Sandy, I always remember Sandy. She walked on and gave him his cloak, and he put the cloak on. She helped him put the cloak on. And as she walked off, he went, "Thanks, love." And then he collapsed. Oh. And she turned and laughed, and the audience laughed. Oh. And we laughed in the wings. And David Bell, the producer, kind of looked, and it then became uncomfortable, and the audience wondered whether they should be laughing. And David Bell looked and then said, "Is that a joke?" to Tommy's son, Tommy Jr., who was in the wings with us. He said, "That's not a joke. My dad's got a bad back, and he wouldn't be able to get up from that." So David Bell coolly said, "Cue music, cue commercial break." The band played, the commercial break happened. We, Dustin and I, thought, well, because the paramedics ran on and moved him behind the curtains, and we thought, well, surely that will the show will stop now, and they'll put on a repeat of The Professionals or something.
Yeah.
And they didn't. David Bell and Jimmy Tarbuck said, "Are you guys ready to go on?" The commercial break was suddenly over.
Did you know at this point he'd died?
He hadn't died. Okay. They'd pulled him back, and I think the paramedics were seen to him, and he died later in St. Thomas's Hospital.
Right.
But, you know, kind of certainly we knew that something was not right. And we kind of then had to go on and work in front of the tabs that he was working in front of, which we wouldn't have done. We would have been on an open kind of 80s spangly light bulby set that David Bell loved so much.
Yeah.
But we worked in front of those tabs and carried on and I suppose held the fort.
Gosh. Could you hear stuff going on? Could you hear things happening behind you?
Well, funnily enough, Dustin, who used to do this impression of Robert Mitchum, brilliant impression of Robert Mitchum, afterwards he said, "I went to get my Robert Mitchum hat and I heard somebody say, 'It's okay, he's been sick.'" Mm. So this is all going on, and we're live on TV, and we are somehow pulling an audience out of their confusion, and we did really well that night. And we came off, and afterwards Dustin said, that's the way I'd like to go. I'd like to go with my boots on. And 2 years later in Panto, when we were in Southport, he collapsed on New Year's Day. As we, in the middle of the show, we were coming off stage, and we were playing Ugly Sisters, and foolishly Broke as Men as well, because Dustin decided we should be playing both parts because he loved a challenge. It was a challenge too far, though, and he came off, and in the wings he just collapsed and went into a coma and died a couple of days later. So you should be careful what you wish for when you say things like that, when you say, I want to go that way.
I was about to make a glib comment about, oh, if it's me, then I guess it'll be mid-podcast. I'm not going to make that comment now.
No. I tell you what, be careful that, you know, working with me, I've got a reputation.
Bloody hell. I'm going to go get a full health check after the show. Toaster. 2016, Les Dennis.
Yes.
Some nice purchases here. I think.
Oh, I start buying things. Suddenly realise what Amazon's about.
It kicks off, or you give your password and log into your other half. It kicks off. Either way, it kicks off. We've got John Adams' Tiny Tears Best Friends. Some nice dolls here. A Bayer design twin dolls pram. I sense there might be some little people in your life at this point.
Yeah, I'm an older dad. I've got a 41-year-old son, Philip, from my first marriage to Lynn. I was 26 when he was born. And then at the age of 55, I became a dad again to Eleanor.
Wonderful.
And I remember Barry Cryer, my lovely mate, saying, 55 is a great age to be a new dad because you're up three times a night anyway. So Eleanor was born. So that makes me really, because she's 13 now. So, you know, the idea of dolls and dolls prams, although she still loves them, and I love the fact that she does. You know, the fact that it's only 2016 since those days and how quickly they go. And I've got Tom, who's now 10, so there'll probably be some purchases that were bought for Tom as well.
Gorgeous.
But what was it? Tiny Tears
Best Friends. One's in blue, one's in pink, fully gendered. Those were the days. Stop it. A Georgie interactive puppy toy as well. This is such a powerful way to look at the advancing years of your little ones, because I've got two. I've got a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old, and I am just so, it makes me well up thinking about it. I'm just so conscious that you're watching the sand. I know it sounds really melancholic, a really melancholic thing to say, but there is a part of your brain going, enjoy this, mate, cherish this.
Yeah. I did The Addams Family. I played Fester. And my lovely mate Cameron Blakely played Gomez.
Yes.
He played Gomez, and he had this wonderful song about Wednesday kind of growing. It's called A Little Happy, A Little Sad. And it's that thing about watching your little girl go from a little girl to a young woman. And it's a beautiful song. And I remember, you know, Eleanor was still a little girl when I did that show. And now she's at that stage where I was in buckets then, you know, the anticipation of that. And now if I was in that show with him now, I'd be bawling.
But how wonderful that, you know, you managed to have two more, you know, and you got to go through it all over again. Do you think as an older dad, do you appreciate those moments even more, because it must have been not something you thought would happen when you were, say, 45 or whatever?
Yeah, I think, you know, I love it. And it came out of nowhere. I remember I bought a house in Highgate and did it up. And then I thought, well, what am I doing this for? This is a family house. And I sold it. I now kind of mourn that house, thinking that was the house for Claire and the kids and me. And we've moved north now, and we have a lovely house here. But that was the perfect London home for us. And at the time, I just thought, I don't need this. I'm a single man that's never going to go there. And I did. So you can never say what you're going to do in life and where life is going to take you.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course. Such good advice. Also, if you ever sell a house like that, just keep the keys. Just break back in.
That's right. It's that hindsight thing as well with properties and houses. You know, you always go, oh, Well, you know that. I could have bought that.
I grew up with my parents always yabbering on about should have held on to this, should have held on to that. And you just think, no, you did what you did in the moment. You can't, and you,
exactly.
you know, and you can't think of houses. And of course, this whole generation do this. You can't think of houses as assets. They are a thing you live in, then you move on because your life has moved on. But
I think that, you know, certainly with COVID, people have realized that they maybe don't need to live in London anymore, that they might want to get out and have a bit more space, but not necessarily have to be chained to their desk anymore.
Absolutely. Or talking of being chained, we've got a man who enjoyed performing in prisons, Johnny Cash.
San Quentin.
Oh God, I get really aggressive about Johnny Cash. Oh bloody love him. Oh,
love him. I love him, and I love this album. My mum had this album when we were kids. We had a radiogram, and I remember that there was a lot of Sinatra, Tony Bennett, I Left My Heart in San Francisco being the song that would play every Sunday morning. My mum would have it on as I was her commie chef making Sunday dinner. We didn't have Sunday lunch. That's too posh. I'm from Liverpool, working class Liverpool. So it was Sunday dinner while my dad was out at the pub having his 3 or 4 pints on a Sunday afternoon with his mates. Yeah. I would be commie chef with my mum, and we'd listen to Tony Bennett and Frank Sinatra and Johnny Cash. And that San Quentin album was there, you know, and something that my mum loved, you know, that song, San Quentin, I Hate Every Inch of You. The fact that he did that in front of that crowd is incredible, that you know, that he managed to avoid a riot with the humor and with the pathos of that song, the kind of the magic of his performance as well.
San Quentin, may you rot and burn in hell. May your walls fall and may I live to tell. May all the world forget you ever stood. And may all the world regret you did no good.
It's amazing, and just that idea. And I guess maybe we have a more resonant appreciation of it. I don't know, that might be putting us on a throne. But in terms of doing a gig in a prison, not once, but twice.
Yeah, twice.
And
yeah,
to
absolutely.
Hear, when you hear that roar noise of the crowd, that sends a shiver down my spine every time.
It does, absolutely. And I thought Joaquin Phoenix did a great job.
Brilliant job,
Recreating that icon, that wonderful, and he sang himself, didn't he? He did. It wasn't miming to Johnny Cash. It was his voice. And if you listen to the later Johnny Cash albums, you know, as he's dying, you know, those incredible songs of kind of grief and loss and you know, just a life lived.
Yeah.
And you know, you certainly know that about Johnny Cash. He's not just a performer who goes on stage and is a persona. It is him.
Yeah.
We get everything there.
If you haven't, dear listener, if you haven't heard American Four, The Man Comes Around, which has got, which is that album, it's got like Hurt on it, which it's just, I'm sure you guys must have heard it there. But they're,
that's it. Hurt is a wonderful track, isn't it?
Oh, it just, I remember hearing that when it first came out, and I was at Edinburgh doing, I was doing 3 shows a day at Edinburgh, and I listened to that album constantly. And at the end of the month, I was like, why do I feel really depressed? Oh yeah, it's because I've had Johnny Cash in my ears.
Hello, it's Mr. P here.
And the other Mr. P.
And we are the hosts of 2 Mr. P's in a podcast.
The educational podcast where you don't actually learn a thing.
No, instead we explore the weird, wonderful and downright hilarious things that happen in school from people actually doing the job. We reminisce on our own time at school, funny things we experience each day. And of course, we share your hilarious stories from the chalk face. So if you work in a school or just want a nostalgic trip down memory lane, sit up straight, fingers on lips, and get ready for the lesson.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than 1 billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need.
Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
What else have we got here, Les, Dennis, as we move to 2017 now?
Right.
So we've got, what's this? Okay, now this might be, I don't know if you're going to be comfortable talking about this. Just scream and shout if you want to stop. We've got one here, the normal one, life with a difficult or damaged sibling, and Kane's legacy, liberating siblings from a lifetime of secrecy and regrets. That's pretty
wow.
heavy stuff.
What are they called again?
One's called Kane's Legacy.
Right.
And one's called the normal one, Life with a Difficult or Damaged Sibling. This is pretty heavy stuff here.
I think this might have been something that my wife Claire bought and bought it in my name, because I certainly haven't read either of those books. And she is a kind of a relationship coach.
Okay,
So, you know, that's her background. So she might have been researching something and has bought those books. But it's kind of, I think we all have, I have a great relationship with my siblings. You know, I have two sisters and a brother, Ken. And my elder sister, Marg, is like the matriarch of our family. She really is. You know, she is. Well, my mum died in 1977, right, and my dad died in 1982. So I've been without parents since, you know, my
30s.
Which, you know, so our Marg, as we all call her, in Liverpool, you always preface somebody's name with R.
Yeah.
You know, it's R Marg, R Ken, R Mandy. but it's me mom and me dad. Yeah. Even when it's talking to them, it's suddenly my when it comes to parents. But R Marg is the kind of rock, my rock, really. You know, when I've had bad times in my life, you know, I could always call Marg at any time, day or night, and she was there and is still there for me.
That's so good to hear.
I think siblings, you know, are the family. It's they're the ones that will be there always. You know, friends are great, and you can always rely on friends. But friends come and go, and friends change. But your family are always there.
Yeah, totally. What did your parents do right, Les? This sounds like they were just brilliant. You've got this wonderful. You've got tight siblings, because that's not easily done. I've got two elder brothers, and they're much older than me, and we get on really, really well. And I do always think, despite my parents being massively flawed people, as all parents are, I do think, wow, you got this right. You made us thick as thieves. I don't know how.
Yeah, my mum was a real believer in kind of self-improvement and self-improvement for her family. I read when we were at school, I think our O-level book was Sons and Lovers.
Yeah.
The D.H. Lawrence novel about Paul Morrell and his relationship with his mother and his father. And I kind of really identified with this boy who wanted to self-improve and had a mother who was absolutely sure that he would. And my mum, you know, we lived in, like I say, we lived in working class Liverpool, but we lived in a prefab in Speke, you know, one of those kind of post-war kind of self-built homes that sprung up in the suburbs of different cities. And so we lived in this tiny prefab, but my mum was always determined that we would move on, and she got us to Childwall, which was quite a posh part of Liverpool. We were in a council house, but we were in a council house in Childwall. And she then, when it came to her ambitions, she wanted to drive, and my dad laughed. My dad was content with his lot. My dad had worked on the docks, and then he was he worked for a bookmaker. He managed betting shops, and my mum worked in factories all her life. But she decided she wanted to drive, and she said, I'm going to start a car box. She had a little money box, and we all laughed because she wrote on it in biro, Mum's car box. And we just thought, no chance. And she put her pennies and sixpences in, and she got a car.
No, she did it.
She did it. And she didn't pass until her fifth time. But,
excellent.
You know, she kind of... She did it, and much against the grumbling of my dad, who tried driving lessons once and got out and said, never a bloody again.
So she was driving and he wasn't?
He wasn't, yeah. Okay. Yeah. My dad never learned to drive and also kind of never wanted to. So my mum did that, and then she got us to, you know, I went to Quarry Bank, the school that John Lennon had gone to.
Right.
And again, she made sure when it came to 11 plus time that I worked hard and that I got to the school that I wanted to go to.
Yeah.
So, and then when I wanted to do what I do now,
yeah,
she was really encouraging as well. I suppose like our Marg is the matriarch now, she was the matriarch of our family, and well, clearly she was the mother,
yeah,
but she really was so invested in our kids, and you know, would come over when we used to play football on the back fields. My mum had come and play as well.
Oh, excellent.
And she had one of the most unusual football injuries. She was getting ready to go out that night, and she had rollers in her hair, and she headed the ball, and the roller went with the pin, stabbed her head.
Oh my god.
So.
Been catastrophic.
It could have been catastrophic.
Amazing.
But yeah, so I when you say what did they do right, I think they just were there for us when we needed them.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think that your mum with rollers in her head, did that inspire you when you were doing your famous impression many years later?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, my mum, again, was someone who wanted to perform, and she'd had a chance when she was a kid of performing on a talent show with a guy called Carol Levis, who was, it was called Carol Levis Discoveries. It was a radio talent show.
Yeah.
And she got a chance to do it, and her mum refused her from doing it, said, no, you start in the Bobbins Works on Monday morning. So she had a job to go to. And she was, what, 15, I think.
Wow.
And she went straight to work. So she could see in me that I wanted to do it. So that car that she had saved up for was the vehicle that she would drive me around to the clubs when I was still underage for driving. Because I started doing the working men's clubs while I was still at school. So my mum would drive me around and take me to the clubs.
Wow. In that car that she saved up for. It's all...
In that car.
Oh, it's
that
all so
Morris
connected.
1100.
Oh, yeah. But if it wasn't for your gran telling,
yeah, that's
telling,
right,
your mum no, she would never, yeah, have had the energy to say yes to you in that way.
Exactly.
And look where we are now.
Exactly. 9406LV, the registration plate of that car.
You never forget. L358DNU. You never forget the reg of your first car.
Yeah.
It's so
true. I couldn't tell you the reg of my car now.
No, I had no idea. Couldn't tell you the colour of my car now, though, so I've got a clue.
What's the purchase history of this jokester? Stay tuned for my mate bought a toaster.
So hang on, how old were you when you were first out doing the working men's clubs then?
I was 17 when I did my first paid gig.
Mm.
When I was 16, my mum, again, she worked in a factory, and there was a club called the Norgreen Social Club, and she knew the concert secretary who was at the factory with her, and he got me my first experience on stage. You know, they would put me on in working men's clubs for 10 minutes,
yeah,
in between the acts that were booked, and pay me my expenses.
I see.
But when I got £2 expenses at that Norgreen Social Club for 10 minutes, and I was working all day at a do-it-yourself shop on a Saturday for £1.
Oh, there you go.
Lugging, you know, all sorts of trays of tiles up and down stairs. I thought, oh, this is quite good.
this is nice. Just a bit of quick maths there. £2 for that, yes.
And then at 17, I did my first, you know, paid gig, as in, you know, I was the act that was booked for the night. And very often, and I remember it was Melling Ratepayers was the club I did. In fact, I was going to do a show this year, and COVID stopped it from happening. Phil McIntyre had a tour lined up for me, 50 years of being Les Dennis, because it's 50 years this July since I did Opportunity Knock. So I kind of count that as my 50 years in show business. I was 17. And when I did the Melling Ratepayers, I thought, well, I'll go back this year and get and charge them the £7 I got that first time.
Excellent.
In 1971 and use it as a tryout gig.
Yes.
But, we'll hopefully get that tour up and running at some point.
Yeah, of course. Fantastic stuff. Okay, all right. Look, let's come crashing back into the present. Here we are, 2018. And again, I'm sensing little ones here. Fantastic Four. Wizard School uniform. Have we got a Harry Potter fan in our midst here? Because there's a lot of Harry Potter business here.
Yeah, I mean, they're both Harry Potter fans, and that probably would be... does it coincide with World Book Day when they go dressed?
Bang on! February 2018. Yes, I'm sure that's World Book Day. We've got we've got the wand. We've got I was going to say a gown. It's not a gown, is it? What am I thinking?
Right.
Whatever it's called, you know, the thing.
I mean, just lazy dad thinking, you know, I'm not making the costume for you. Get it?
Yeah.
I've discovered Amazon this late in my life, and I've got to... crumple all those boxes and put them into recycling. Yeah. I may as well have an easy time of not having to find a costume for you.
You know, like in have you seen the Thomas Crown Affair? Do you remember that film?
Yeah. Which one? There were two. Well, the original.
I think it counts. Certainly, I've only seen the remake, but in the remake at the end, when he, a bit of a spoiler here for any Thomas Crown Affair about to watch, when he disappears into a crowd of other Thomas Crowners, right? That's his famous escape. He walks into everyone's dressed in the same way. That is World Book Day with Harry Potter costumes.
You're absolutely right.
They walk out of the house and you're like, bye, darling, enjoy. Oh, my God, which one's mine? And they've gone.
Well, you've taken me back now to the original Thomas Crown Affair, which was a brilliant film with Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway. Yes. And they have a game of chess that is the sexiest game of chess and goes on for minutes and minutes. I did Birds of a Feather Christmas special last year, and we kind of recreated, Leslie Joseph and I did a spoof of that with Jenga.
fantastic.
And the song from that film was Like a Wheel Within a Wheel, Noel Harrison, the son of Rex Harrison.
Yes. That's so funny, because I haven't seen that film, but I totally know that reference.
Yeah.
The circles of your mind. I did warm up for Birds of a Feather for a while. I wasn't on that.
Did you?
Yeah. Wow. My God, that was fun. I used to watch it as a kid. I loved it. It got me into the idea of sitcoms, watching Birds of a Feather with my mum.
Yeah.
It was such a good blueprint for a perfect sitcom.
Yeah. And Marks and Gran, you know, who wrote it, also did Goodnight, Sweetheart.
How? I mean, this is a silly question. I feel like there's some sort of Les Dennis Kirby enthusiasm hybrid, but would you love a kind of a good, strong, solid modern sitcom vehicle now? You'd be perfect for that sort of thing, wouldn't you?
I'd love that. You know, kind of doing extras with Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant was such a joy and such a kind of reinvention for me. And kind of the fact that I was playing as they called it a twisted, demented version of myself was, and they said to me when I kind of looked quizzically, they said, think Larry Sanders, think Curb Your Enthusiasm. So I think, I think a grumpy Les would be, because you've just said that everybody in the business says, oh, Les Dennis is so lovely. But I have my grumpy side and I would love to play that. We did out of extras. There was Life Too Short with Warwick Davis, and there was an Easter special with myself, the wonderful, greatly missed Keith Chegwin and Sean Williamson, and we were again playing ourselves, but kind of as a road show, the three of us. I mean, Warwick's idea was that individually you're Z-listers, but together the three of you might make a D-lister, and we might be able to put a tour together. So we did a special with, bizarrely, Val Kilmer in the mix as well. And it was very funny and kind of missed, I think. It was one of those shows of Ricky's that didn't get seen that much, but I thought was lovely to do, and I would love to do. Yeah, sitcom would be great. Yeah,
that moment, 2005, was when you did extras. That must have been that was a big left turn, wasn't it? That was a big, or certainly a big reinvention for you at that point.
Yeah, it was, and it came at the right time, because you know a lot of things were not going great. I'd done Big Brother, and or even though I came second to Mark Owen, I came out to headlines of, you know, is this the most pathetic man in Britain? and not the best reaction. So when Ricky called and asked me to play this part, I was thrilled. And even though my friends were like going, be careful, because his humour can be cruel and you don't want them to be, you know, subject to them taking the mickey out of you.
Yeah.
But when I read the script and when they gave me those references of Curb and Larry Sanders, I just thought, no, this is a chance for me to do something that will reinvent.
Yes, it really did. And it's so funny that these things come along and with no pre-planning. This is what I love about our business. I love that about our business. I'm just going to sit here and look at my phone. Something will pop up.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I've just got two jobs and suddenly my year is looking good and it wasn't. And that's the exciting thing about, as you say, this business. You know, you never know the what's ahead. And if you're in a comfortable 9-to-5, then you have that comfort and that security. We don't have that. We have feast or famine.
We do.
But when feast comes, it's suddenly, it's lovely.
Exactly. We are at the casino. We're the broken people at the casino at 3 a.m. We're happy here. We're happy here, all right? you enjoy your pensions and your normal lives. Having said that, if there is famine, Les, it's fine. Don't panic, because you've bought the on the 31st of May 2018 an adjustable portable stainless steel dog grooming table and a pet grooming scissor kit. Do you want to explain this?
Well, yeah, again, I know exactly this because I remember looking at Claire and going, what are you doing? And why did she buy it through me instead of go on her own account? I don't know. We, at that time, had one dog called Dizzy. We now have two dogs, Dizzy and Maya. Dizzy is a Lhasa poo. So that's a Lhasa Apso poodle cross.
Lovely.
Maya is, they call her a Shih Tzu.
Good.
Which is a Shih Tzu poodle cross. I think it's a polite way of
not
saying Shih Tzu. I just call it Shih Tzu.
I call it Shitty Poo. Come on, get stuck in.
Shitty Poo.
Double down.
And certainly for the first, she's nearly a year now, and for the first 6 months, she lived up to that name. my kids love it that I called her Shitty Arse, and they just love that. Because my mum used to use that phrase when I was a kid.
Excellent.
And they just love that. Maya is Shitty Arse. So Claire, I think, just thought, because Eleanor, my daughter, is absolutely animal obsessed.
Okay.
And we now have rabbits, and we now have a hamster, and we have two dogs and a cat.
Oh.
It's, you know, it never stops.
Oh, I love
but
it.
But basically, I think the Eleanor was like, I want to be able to do this for Dizzy, to be able to groom her.
Right.
And I think she had a go. That table is now sat in the garage.
Is it really completely unused?
With all the other stuff that doesn't get used,
If my dog saw that table. So basically, to describe it, it looks like something you'd see in a lab, except there's a sort of, there's a frame over the top of it, and that is the thing you harness the dog onto, so they have to tie the lead to it. And I've got a very old, smelly labradoodle there. She's called Polly. Polly Wally Doodle. And she absolutely honks, and she has to get the shitty-ass curtains dealt with by a groomer. And if we walk past the groomer on a normal day and she's near the shop still now, she shivers, she shakes. I don't know what that groomer's doing to her, but she is terrified. Completely
Dizzy's
terrified.
The same. Dizzy, absolutely. If we pass her, when we lived in London and wherever she got groomed then, we passed that shop, she would drag her heels and I'd have to really pull, and it would probably be at a time when the press were trying to get photos of me.
Les Dennis,
Les Miserables and his little dog. And then now where we are, she goes straight there and I send her in. And the last time I took her, she got off the lead and legged it.
Out of the shop. Gone.
Luckily it was a little lane with it was at the top of a lane we used to live in, so she just legged it back to our old house.
Oh shit.
Patreon. Patreon.com/toasterpod. Patreon.com/toasterpod.
21st of June 2018. Oh, you've done a thing. You've done the thing. Many of my guests have done this. Dom Jolly is perhaps the worst person for doing this. You have bought your own produce. You've done it. You've bought two copies, of course, of Les Dennis's Must the Show Go On. This is in June 2018. Quite right, too. If you can't buy your own book on Amazon, what can you do? So this book, and I'm looking at it on Amazon. Bloody hell, it's got some fantastic reviews.
Is it? Oh, good.
Probably don't want to know that. You're probably avoiding the reviews for your sanity. But no, it's incredible. It's got almost all 5-star reviews. Funny but emotional, star-studded, also personal, absolutely fantastic, charmingly endearing. There you are, Les. There's a bit of smoke up your ass. There you are.
There you go. That's lovely. I wrote this in 2008. So when did I buy it?
You bought it.
This copy.
You bought it in 2018, 10 years later.
2018. Well, yeah. I think that's because, you know, when I wrote this book, they gave me a batch of them and then the paperbacks. And I slowly ran out because friends would say, have you got a copy? And I'd give copies away. And eventually I didn't have a copy myself. So in 2018, I think I again had been asked by somebody about it. And so I thought, well, I better buy a copy. In fact, I can see that copy on the bookshelf right now. I was proud of this because I couldn't come up with a title for ages and ages and ages. And I also, when Johnny Gillam, my literary agent, when I was with Curtis Brown at that time, and he said, look, you know, we'll see if we can get a deal. And I went, but I don't want a ghost-written book. And he went, well, you know, people always say that. I said, well, what about if I write 2 or 3 chapters and send them to you? And so I did that, and he said, okay, go ahead. You can do it. Okay. So I wrote it longhand because I'm such a Luddite.
Oh, I'm getting hand cramp just thinking of it. Oh, no.
And Claire, my wife, in 2008, we hadn't known each other. We met in 2005. So it was a perfect way of her finding out about my life. She typed it up for me and kind of, she didn't edit, but she certainly was great at, you know, just suggesting the way it should go. And so I was very proud of it because I wanted it to be warts and all, and I wanted to explore who Leslie Heseltine / Les Dennis was, because they're two different people. Leslie Heseltine, you know, isn't keen on getting up and being entertaining, but Les Dennis will do 20 minutes when the fridge door opens. So, you know, and so this has always been the struggle in my life. So I wanted also to look at the fact that when my mum had died, when my dad had died, and then when Dustin had died, I went on stage, you know, all 3 times. And I wouldn't do that now. You know, I believe that I held my grief in and I crashed and burned after that. And my first marriage went on the back burner and then was ruined. And my life was all over the place after those 3 deaths. And so I wanted to explore all of that and be honest about it. So I'm really pleased that people have written nice reviews about it because it is an honest book. And I remember going on Front Row and Mark Lawson saying how much he'd enjoy it. I was like, okay.
Oh, I'll take that. Okay, oh, that Mark Lawson, blimey. Yeah.
So and in 2018, I bought it again. And just recently, with a friend who is a radio producer, I've been reading it into this microphone and thinking about putting it out as an audiobook because it never was an audiobook. The only odd thing about it is...
You must do that. Yes, of course.
Yeah, but then when you're going, you know, and my fiance Claire, and you know, it's at a time before now, you know, that was then, this is now. So you think, oh, well, I've changed so many things now. So maybe I need to update it as well reading it.
It sounds like 2005 was a heck of a year for you, considering that there are certain bad things that have just happened. We've talked about people passing away. We've talked about family fortunes is gone. The marriage has fallen apart. You've had bad times on coming out of Celebrity Big Brother. Suddenly Claire appears. You get extras happens. That was a real crossroads moment, wasn't it?
It was, absolutely. Yeah, and it's exactly that. You don't... If you knew what was coming in front of you, I think you'd be scared of it. But you know, you don't have to always be scared about it because great things happen to us all the time if we believe. You know, and I think that one of people say to me, "What's your best achievement?" And I think for me, it's still being around in this business because it's a difficult business to stay around in. And from 1971 to now, I'm still here. That's what I kind of, that Stephen Sondheim song, "I'm Still Here," rings in my ears all the time because I've managed to reinvent and keep going. But you never know whether that's the right thing, and which, when you take a path, you don't know you're necessarily going on the right path.
No.
Or rather, come off a path. That's what I tend to do. Is like we talked about that Guardian review. I make left turns, but the path is coming round.
Absolutely, and there's just always this sense. You've got to have the sense of, well, you know, if something bad happens, well, maybe it's bad, or maybe, you know, maybe we'll see. It's just that. Yeah. It's just that inner optimism, and you can't really you can't really buy that. That's just DNA. That's baked in.
Yeah, I suppose it is. Yeah, yeah. Kind of, it's using your and trusting your instincts, isn't it?
Absolutely. All right. Okay. Listen, let's hit upon 2020 now.
Oh, right. Okay.
We're gonna leap on forward a little bit. And I don't know if you know, there was a sort of a pandemic thing in 2020.
Yeah, that thing happened, didn't it? Yeah.
Just before, this is 2019 technically. 13th of December, the Sony PlayStation 4. Yes.
I don't use it. I have never been into video games. I think Mario Brothers I quite liked, but I don't think you can get Mario Brothers. I was very disappointed. I talked to Tom and said, "Can you get Mario Brothers on PS4? But can you? I don't know.
You've got to get a Nintendo Switch, mate. I used to love Mario Brothers, and I got my boy a Switch about 3 years ago. Right. He's completely bored of it now, and he always messes around on the iPad, on my blooming iPad I'm trying to use for work. So I go and grab his Switch and play Mario on it. A Switch, Les. There you are.
Get a Switch. Okay, well, you know, so Tom is PS4 mad, and he's kind of... We really said no to Fortnite for so long, and then we... all his peers, and certainly because they are sitting there during the pandemic, they were sitting and connecting with their mates. So the fact that he wanted to play with his mates, we gave into Fortnite. Oh my God, the requests for skins.
Oh no.
For Robux and all that stuff as well. So, you know, I don't know. It's a world I go in and sit with him and try to have a go. I haven't got a clue what's going on.
I think there is a lot of people get sniffy about kids playing computer games. And I think you have to go every now and again. This is my very naive approach to it. Sit with them and sort of watch and go what you do. 10 minutes of that. My sons love it when I do that. And then I can naff off and I get a good couple of hours without them. So, you know.
You're right. You're absolutely right. If you show an interest and you just go,
what's going on here?
There's a cat skin. Okay. And Tom was like, "Look at this cat skin, Dad." And he said, "It's a bit like Mickey Mouse, isn't it? It's old-fashioned. It's black and white." I went, "It's like Felix the Cat." So I Googled Felix the Cat for him, and he went, "Wow, it is. That's what it is." So suddenly I got brownie points for knowing what the reference was.
My dad is so cool. He gets my dad, Les Dennis. My dad really gets cat skins. Really gets them. Really gets them. All right, look, here we go. 2021 now. We've got Marvel classic novels, Wolverine, all the Marvel stuff. Now I've been in Marvel denial for a long, long time. Right. And then recently we got Disney Plus, and I watched all the Marvel films with my wife and kids, and they are so good. It's unfathomable. It's basically a decade of these movies now. They're incredible.
And he's great, isn't he? The greatest showman guy, Hugh Jackman.
Oh,
he's incredible.
Yes.
And the Logan. I really enjoyed the Logan movie.
Yes.
Did you see that, Logan? The kind of... that is a... Is it still a Wolverine?
Yes, it's Wolverine. It's Wolverine, but sort of later on and broken.
And broken, that's right, yeah. I enjoyed that. And I think the reason that that Wolverine novel has been bought is, in Tom's defense, again, World Book Day, and teachers saying you can't use comics or comic characters. And so we bought the novel, and Tom started reading the novel because you can say he's reading it's a character from a novel.
It was
a way into him going to World Book Day as Wolverine.
Absolutely. Listen, my kids are currently reading, well, my eldest is currently reading a Minecraft chapter book. I couldn't care less that it's Minecraft. He is sitting down on the sofa and reading a book.
Exactly, exactly. I'm absolutely with you on that.
Take the win. For God's sake, take the win. Good, we've got Wolverine claws here. Very nice indeed, I assume, for the kids.
Yeah. Trying to watch Tom on the trampoline wearing those claws is a worry, though. It is. I'm just like, get them off. Take them off.
It's like your mum heading the ball with the rollers in again. No. 3rd of February 2021, The Dresser by Ronald Hartwood. Is this Ronald, you?
It's a great play. Based on, I think Ronald Hartwood was a dresser who worked for Wolfit. And there was a film with Albert Finney and Tom Courtney. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a television version with Ian McKellen and Anthony Hopkins. And it's a play that I've always wanted to do. And I used to want to play the dresser, but now I want to play Sir.
Yes.
So I did the RSC a couple of years ago, and there's a lovely actor, John Hodgkinson. And
I know his wife, Rosa, incredibly well.
Oh, do you really? She's lovely, isn't she?
So basically, very
she
tenuous.
She teaches, doesn't she?
She's a teacher, very, very tenuous. I'll probably cut this out. My wife's best friend, Lydia, is Rosa's sister. And John and I were the same agent. There we are, small world.
Okay, well, John and I said, well, let's try and think about doing The Dresser. So I must have bought a copy thinking about that, and then found out that the rights to it are not available at the moment. I wonder if because of theatre being tentatively back but not properly back, that writers are not allowing the rights of their plays out until they know there's going to be an audience.
Yeah, yeah. John is a great actor. You should definitely
do
that.
He's a great actor. In fact, we talked about kind of maybe alternating. So we play Dresser and Sir.
That's a good idea.
Do it, because it has been done a few times, The Dresser. So I was trying to work out a way of doing it differently. I went, what about if we do what Benedict Cumberbatch when they did
Frankenstein. Yes, that's a great idea. It's just interesting, this thing that you're talking about, the RSC. I had no idea that you did stuff at the RSC. If you come to plays later on, or is it one of those things where you're like, no, I've always done them, but people just knew me better for Family Fortunes, kind of thing?
I think it was something when I was young, I used to go to the Everyman Theatre in Liverpool and watch an amazing company of actors in the 70s that I don't know how. There was an artistic director there called Alan Dosser, and he managed to get the very young Jonathan Pryce, Alison Steadman, Bernard Hill, Anthony Scher, Trevor Eve, all these Bill Nighy, Matthew Kelly, all the Julie Walters.
Oh my
this
God.
Company of actors.
Stop it. It's
were
ridiculous.
Incredible and just starting out. So my love of theatre was fired then. And I always thought, well, I want to do that. But I'd already started down the working men's clubs and the comedy route. So when Family Fortunes came along, it gave me the chance, the luxury, because it only took 3 weeks a year to film a whole series.
Wow.
It gave me the luxury to be able to go and do a play at a rep. I went to the Watermill in Newbury and did David Hare's Skylight, which was real baptism by fire. Yeah. And then I did Misery at Oldham Coliseum. And I learned my craft as an actor by working with directors who taught me. So it's something that I always wanted. And when I was 17, I went to Stratford and sat in the theatre and watched Twelfth Night and just thought, I want to do that. Mm. And then 2 years ago, I got the chance to do it and went to Stratford and had a fantastic time. Just a lovely season.
And is it Les Dennis who's wanting to do that? And is Leslie Heseltine sitting there going, oh, no, not more of this?
Well, Leslie Heseltine, I think, wants... I think Leslie Heseltine is the actor and Les Dennis is the performer. And you've only made me just realise that the Leslie Heseltine side of me is the kind of the one that wants to get on stage, but with other people. That's the wonderful thing I think about. You know what it's like as a stand-up? I mean, when I started at stand-up, the term didn't exist. I was a turn. I did me act. Then as I got older, I got fed up of being on my own in dressing rooms, because I know the comedy circuit that you guys worked is more likely that you're all working with other comedians. But in the working men's clubs, you didn't. You worked with a guitar vocalist or a band, a show band or whatever, and were on in between the bingo. So I got fed up of going round and living that lonely existence. And for me, being part of a company of actors is fantastic.
Yes.
To be there with other people and feeling like it's a collaborative process.
Absolutely. Because you do, there is a bond with other stand-ups in the green room, but it's only so thick. Whereas when you've got the collaboration of other actors, it's a whole different different ball game. It is. And look, March 2021, as we come towards the end of this episode, Les, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this. Thank you.
I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, it's just brilliant. And we can see, look, we can see the two different people here. We've got... I would say this is Les Dennis buying the ring lights, getting ready for some nice Zoom broadcasting here. And then maybe the showbiz Les Dennis here buying electric toothbrush heads, keeping those Nashers sparkly and white for the new bright light you've got shining on them.
Well, the light was something I had to buy because that thing of doing self-tapes and holding it shakily in front of you or sticking it on a pile of books, I thought I've got to get a bit more professional about this. And then my kids saw it and went, TikTok. No. So that was something that I did as a legitimate expense for the business. And I've had all of three self-tapes since I bought it. But there you go. But then the toothbrush, that's the nagging dad.
Yes.
That's the nagging dad going, kids, teeth. It's the one thing that they get fed up, I think, hearing me nag them before school, after school, before they go to bed. And, you know, when I see them just using an ordinary toothbrush, I go, no, let's get the head sorted on the on the electric one and get it. In fact, I think earlier I'd bought another the charger.
Yeah, because, I can see that here. I bet that's already in a disgusting state. They're clean for about 3 minutes.
Yeah, that's because my other dog had chewed the charger, so I had to buy the charger as well.
Yeah, I love it. The chaos is perfect. Listen. Les Dennis, the lovely Leslie Heseltine and the much loved Les Dennis, this has been such a privilege to chat to you on My Mate Bought a Toaster. Thank you for coming on.
I've loved it and I've loved the show and I'll keep listening.
Thank you. The fabulous Les Dennis on My Mate Bought a Toaster. How wonderful is he? Oh, I enjoyed that far too much. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, it would be amazing if you get a chance to give us a review. Give us a follow on the socials at ToasterPod. And don't forget to subscribe. And then that way, every week, the new episodes will be landing on your device and then in your ears first thing Wednesday morning. Oh, and guess who is on the show next week? Annika Rice, team. Yes. Would you like to know what she thought of the show?
Brilliant format. Oh, God, it's the funniest I've come across, to be honest.
And Annika Rice is never wrong. That's why they call her Annika Wright. Sorry, it's been quite a long day. Anyway, the Annika Rice episode will be out next week or on Patreon at some stage today. Don't forget, we've got the Patreon, patreon.com/toasterpod, where you can get Annika Rice's brand new episode. And there will be an Adam Buxton episode dropping on there very soon. Indeed, have a great day. Enjoy this glorious weather. Put some sun cream on. See you soon. Bye.
GreatBigOwl.com.
I'm Tilly Steele.
And I'm Helen Monks.
And this is Bitchin'.
I'm dyslexic.
Yeah, why do you read the Wikipedia page?
It's good to practice.
A podcast where every week we talk about a different person.
So how old was he when he first popped on the scene?
That's a great
if
question.
If you say he was my age, I'm gonna fucking die.
And we veer wildly off track.
Pop that Prosec.
Available on all your podcast apps. That's not my... just
can you not say in the advert?
Available on all your podcast platforms. Just search Bitchin' or Great Big Owl.
We'll see you there.
That was all right.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.